That's really hard. Try it. And just, it's an oxymoron. I'm going to do nothing. And yet, I think you do, I think you come to that just inadvertently or intuitively. Because you and first of all, you try like hell to get enlightened. That's 5 years. You have a nervous breakdown or whatever. So I think you begin by, well, sometimes you just fall into silence, just inadvertently, because you're very innocent and gullible and actually believe what the teacher says. And then you get really smart and try to do something. So the idea is to say, like with the breath, just to know the breath just as it is, without any agenda in the knowing. So the breath is known as long, if it's long. You know the in-breath as the in-breath, the out-breath as the out-breath. If it's coarse, you know it's coarse. If it's refined, you know it's refined. If it's shallow, you know it's shallow. If it's deep, you know it's deep. So it's not the same as pranayama. Right? So pranayama is actually trying to do stuff. And pranayama is great. It can do marvelous things, bring all kinds of energy. So it's useful, very useful. Pranayama is very useful. But this is, so like something like controlling the breath, you do if you're just falling asleep. Yeah, if you're just off to naughty land, and you've had enough you've had enough sleep, so you know it's not a problem of exhaustion. It's just a problem of the mind somehow not knowing how to stay present, and then going very porridge-like. It's like oatmeal, isn't it? Dullness. It's all up here. So then you try to figure out how you can get the energy down here, maybe. And so you direct your attention to your throat and to your belly, and maybe you breathe into your belly and do pranayama or deep breathing or something like that. So that's quite important to know how to manipulate the breath, I think. Huh? Or if you're very restless and you see your breath is maybe very shallow and up here or some, whatever, wherever it is, you just maybe make it more deep, maybe just relax the out-breath more, and you find you're just trying too hard, and you just do kind of, I'm just a sack of potatoes, not going anywhere, just kind of really floppy, slinky kind of body. You do that with dullness, you'll be floppy and slinky, all right. You'll be on the floor. So no, there's energy. I'm going to put some energy in this thing. So you can really, you can do things in meditation. It's not just... It's certainly not passive some kind of fatalistic sense. So there's vitality going on, and that vitality has to be governed by intelligence and experiment and try and this and that. But I think there comes a time where you kind of figure that stuff out, and in the day there come times where the energy is fairly balanced. And you're not restless, and you're not falling asleep. And then you find you don't have to do much, do you? And you just find, you just, because things are balanced. And then you get more kind of refined considerations about, not so much about the breath, about the very quality of attention. And I think you find just naturally that the need to be willful falls away. And then the doing itself becomes more apparent. You notice the doer, the doing, that kind of falls away, and then there's a more and more stillness, and then maybe stillness itself becomes interesting. What's stillness? What's that like? So it's a kind of inquiry of maybe refinement, and then you do get questions like, who's doing this? Or you just pop that one in, do nothing. But it's not a kind of a command, you know, stop doing things, Viradhammo, because that's willful. That doesn't work, right? But just to kind of say that to yourself, nothing to do. That means you need vitality in the system. Right? If your mind is just kind of going all over the place, then you need to make stronger intentions. So if your mind is really, like Ajahn Sumedho's famous descriptions of his early days of meditation, he would, his mind was so rabid, rampant with thought, he just had to go, let 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 go. He would just use that as a mantra, just kind of constantly. So he filled his mind with two words. But he said he just had to stay with it because, you know, even if you did that, let go, and then boom, he'd be off. So he had to be very, very diligent. Now, he wasn't suppressing thought, but he was choosing an object, like a kind of really coarse thought, and just staying with that all the time. So sometimes you're trying to be too refined when you don't need refinement, you need coarseness, something. Now, of course, after many years of meditation, he says his mind really doesn't think much. It's just not an option available. But that didn't come. It came through a lot of training and understanding and releasing stuff and so on and so forth. So where you're at in the spectrum of that, those possibilities depends on the day, depends on what you practice, depends on your family history. Kind of many, many things. So just to teach it one way would be, just wouldn't work. But if you see that, say, the principle is just to know things as they are, if you see that is the principle, life is like this, and you keep re-encouraging that principle, okay? Remembering, like mindfulness has a component remembering in it. You recollect things. It's not just a kind of functional presence, like, I'm going to be really careful not to drop this or it'll break. Yeah, obviously, but it always has the sense of recollection. So you're recollecting life is like this, and just being able to be in that. Way without any agenda of how it should be or shouldn't be. Of course, when life is painful or unpleasant or the conditions that come through the mind are not nice, then it's very hard to just know it's like this. You want to blame, you want to get rid of, you want to compensate, and that becomes the movement. So you might, just look at how many buttons Mr. Trump presses in human psyches right now. Right? Now, without going into politics, there are some buttons that Mr. Trump presses that say, yeah, go for it. And other buttons say, my God, the world's going down the tube. But that's just your mind. Your mind is doing that, right? Now, without making a position around politics, you could use that to see your reactions. You could take a day of news reading. I mean, it's probably better not to read the news, first of all. That's my higher suggestion. It's called sense restraint. Protect yourself from, but if you choose to torture yourself with these, or you choose to be informed, okay, you choose to be informed because you want to know what's going on, and you want to be able to have an informed discussion with people, and you have policy things you're involved in, fine. But is there any place where you actually notice, like, righteous indignation as an object, hatred as an object, without condoning or condemning anything, just that, oh yeah, this is righteous indignation, it feels this way. So that you begin to kind of use the more stimulating parts of our culture, shall we say, in ways which are also meditative. But again, I'm not excluding, like, that you don't do whatever you do to make this a better planet, but that also that it just takes something like righteous indignation is is a very destructive energy. I'm right, and you're wrong, and I'm right. That's all there is to it. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. How much human suffering has come from that? So hatred can be very much clothed in beautiful clothing, self-righteous clothing, can it? And you know, you can get lots of people to agree with you. But if you were to do the project of 1 year's irritation, annoyance, what do we say? Aversion, hatred, and rage. If that were your 1 year project, then you would have to take on those political beings who you hate. You'd have to make that part of your practice. But that, some people say, oh, then you're condoning. No, no. So we have apparently we have a new premier. I don't follow these things that much. I follow the reactions of others. I'm an observer of observers. But, okay, so, and whatever this person does will affect us, and some of those effects won't be to our liking, okay? And so we deal with that on a social level. But then on the inner level, if I'm sustaining mindsets of they're probably not hatred, they might be, but I'm believing that hatred or aversion or whatever is justified because of this so-and-so, then what I do in stream of consciousness is I reinforce hatred, right? Because that's what the mind will tend to do when it comes across that kind of situation. So can I be against something but also take responsibility for the stream of consciousness? Well, yeah, I can do that. I mean, Nelson Mandela did it, right? So take the highest example. Take the highest example rather than the lowest common denominator. So then you could see, like, you're at your local cocktail party. I'm sure you all go to cocktail parties. Does anyone do that anymore? All right, you're at your OBST. Okay. Yeah, okay, you have an OBST, and then someone unfortunately brings up politics. And then you, wing, 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 everyone starts to, you know, fire off in their political modes. And then, you know, wait a minute, is this right speech? And what's happening with the mind? May all beings be free from suffering, except that guy. You know, and you see the whole Buddhist project falls apart. Which happens in Myanmar now. Right? You get Buddhist monks who should be in prison. So it can, you know, the idealism can be there, but it can slide off very quickly because we humans are kind of really, we can be really stupid. We can do stupid things. So what we're trying to do is then take responsibility. So we could, we could demonstrate against what's going on in Myanmar and so on and so forth, but we might be very angry in our demonstration. And we might feel very self-righteous in our demonstration. And then what are we doing? I mean, mentally we're doing the same thing, aren't we? Right? So when I see that kind of stuff, I'm absolutely appalled that could even happen. But then you read about Japan, that the Zen monks and all were encouraging self-sacrifice for the emperor. And what about the first precept? Where did that go? How do we lose that? So it might not seem like a big thing to hate a politician, but in some sense it's still not right understanding or right practice or right speech or right thought or whatever. But to say that a person is wrong and, you know, it's immoral to do that, and then feel the anger coming up, stay with it and let it subside and come back to the theme and say, no, that is wrong. You can't do that. That's just inappropriate. That's fine, isn't it? It's hard to do. It's a higher goal. So like in a monastery, we had an incident where a chap who had done retreats before, not with me, he, it's great, this is I just think of it now. So the way the meal's set up is that all the monks are waiting for the lay people. The lay people come in, they sit down, and then one lay person says, Bhante, the food can be offered. A junior monk goes out, receives the food, and I just sit there. Lay people are there, maybe a chat. Then we go out and receive the food. Lay people stay in the room, come back in, and then we chant a blessing. So in this one instance, I went out to, you know, we're all out in the kitchen receiving the food, and someone said that one of the guests was smoking dope and encouraging others to smoke dope. And that's for me like a total no-no. So I went back into the room and I was furious. And everyone, you know, I'm usually kind of a teddy bear, but I just looked at this guy, and the people, the lay people, said in the room, my eyes were on fire, and they all looked in the ground. Just not the time. And I just, you know, I was really angry. And I said to the guy, I said, have you been smoking dope and encouraging others to smoke dope? He said, oh, no. Oh, okay, right. And then I just watched the fury, and I just stopped. I just watched the anger. Didn't say anything, and the anger subsided. And then we threw him out. And he was gone in an hour, right? So I both took responsibility for what I thought was appropriate. And that to me, a guy that's already done retreats and smoking, you know, that's just not on for me. Even though I have indulged in a bit of weed, but I wasn't a Buddhist monk then. So, but what was interesting was the kind of, it was like a righteous indignation, that's what it was. But in some ways you could say it was appropriate, it certainly got everyone's toes up. Woo, that was exciting. And he did leave, but I also took responsibility for my anger. I didn't say it was his fault, I knew it was my mind. And I just watched it, and it was really burning. I hadn't been that angry for a long time. And it was gone. Not much residue, right? Because I didn't really believe in some kind of self-righteous way. Now, that's pretty easy. That's a pretty easy thing to deal with. But sometimes, you know, we get stirred up by stuff or whatever. So all the time in Buddhism, we have the social kind of thing that we're involved in, but then also we have flow of consciousness, and we're always taking responsible for the mind, for the feelings and thoughts and ideas. And if those are imbued with greed, hatred, and delusion, right, a lot of me and mine and so on, then if we don't take responsibility, they just get stronger, even though someone might say you're right. But they just get stronger. So if we want to run a freedom mind, you have to do it 24/7. And yet, you know, it's good to say to people, you can't do that. You know, you can't do that. That's wrong. That's wrong to do. So, like, we have some rules in the monastery. If a monk breaks it, he's out. He's finished. And we have some rules in the monastery, no problem, just be careful. So we have a whole kind of range of rules. And the monk might say, but it's not self. Yeah, you could say that, but you're still out. And I've never seen that happen, actually. I've never seen any monk break those rules. But some of the monks that I hear about now who are doing these things, say in Myanmar, they would not be monks. They'd be disrobed right away because... You know, it's not what a monk can do, legally do. So these are troubling things, and that's perhaps the kind of fear we have of institutionalized religion. Like national religion is a very difficult thing because it becomes a place of power and wealth and influence. And so interestingly enough now, we have a new king in Thailand. And they're trying to set up monasteries to be model monasteries of how all the Sangha should behave. There's a kind of a lot going on in Thailand about the Sangha. And so they went to Lompo Liem, our Ajahn Chah's monastery, the biggest monastery we have. And they wanted him to be a role model for other monasteries. He says, no way. you're not going to drag me into that politics, right? He says, we're just quiet monks. We're doing our thing. No, thank you. And so when religion becomes affiliated with power, which it often does, right, then it becomes really tricky. So we're lucky. You know, I don't think I'm ever going to be prime minister or or even an MP. And I certainly didn't want to. But when you see things like that, that's obviously not Buddhism. So people come in, how could Buddhists do that? Well, they're not Buddhists. No, you know, they're just political hacks that have somehow gotten. I think that one guy in Burma he was in prison, if I remember correctly. And he went out and became a monk. You find that in Sri Lanka too, don't you? You know, some really, really difficult pieces. So that, all of that, and you find a lot of corruption in different countries. Thailand's not innocent. So remember, that's not really Buddhism. That's a national problem. That's a cultural problem, right? To throw out then all the rituals of Buddhism and just do mindfulness, I think, would be a real tragedy, because Buddhism is much more than mindfulness. Transcendence, renunciation, the structures of Sangha, the rituals that we have, the iconography, it's very, very rich. Very, very rich, I think. Well, that's why I do this in this outfit. I find it very rich. But the thing about Buddhism, you don't need all those structures. You don't need that. You don't need the rituals. You don't need monks and so on. But do feed me. But yeah, if people tell you, if they kind of lay a trip on you, oh, you're a Buddhist, how could Buddhists do that? You realize that they're just being silly. It's like the Inquisition wasn't really Christian. It was just hateful people doing hateful things. It's just a human problem. But in terms of like present-day politics, do look at your mind and take responsibility for all the modes of aversion, and then maybe make that the project. Like your project this year is to be like, if you want to engage in politics and reading about that, how can you do it from a peaceful place of intelligence rather than a reactive place of how could he tweet that? Or whatever, however it all works. And that's an interesting challenge. Interesting. But I think sense restraint's very important around those things, because they can be very disturbing. Some of the imagery and information and hatred that goes down, it's pretty hard not to get kind of toxic with it. Because it's very toxic. You know, it's very poisonous. Like the mindsets that are portrayed and the righteousness and the hatred, that's very very hard for us to filter that out and not be polluted by it. So there is a big peace in our life, obviously. Sense restraint is a great, and Indriya Samvara is a great source of stillness and peace. But those are personal choices that you make. I've got more limits. All right, shall we do some meditation?